Welcome to this Studio 2 special countdown to Election Day. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. If you like me, this new music had my little heart palpitating a little bit.
I feel like Wolf Blitzer. Wolf Man to Wolf Blitzer.
Yes. Shout out to our producer, Paige, on selecting our new music.
You should keep it going.
I know. While we have this new music, well, we decided here at Studio 2 to do a series of special editions of the show focused on the election. Why? Because there has been a lot of talk about politics in Pennsylvania lately.
Yeah, I don't think we need to ask why.
So,
I think people
So we're doing this thing. But today, another thing that folks have been talking a lot about is the black vote.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this critical voting block for the Democratic Party. And so we decided to do what we do here at Studio 2, bring in some experts, have a deep dive discussion, talk about what it really is. There's been a lot of talk about whether black male voters specifically have abandoned Harris or are shifting over to Trump. There's a question about turnout here in Philadelphia. Will black voters show up at the polls on November 5th? And so we're going to talk about that today. And so our big question for today is, how critical do you think the black voter turnout will be in this election? What are you hearing from black voters? And if you are a black voter, who are you voting for? And what conversations are you having with friends and family? You can call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
Behind the scenes peek here.
Yeah.
We were going to do this show in July.
Yeah.
And then someone dropped out of the presidential race.
Oh, yeah.
And
blew the whole show up. Yeah.
Right. And so we said, let's wait a little bit to mm-hmm. see where the dust settles, especially on the polling. But the polling still shows that Harris is doing a little better with black voters than Biden was doing mm-hmm. in midsummer. There still seems to be, if the polling is accurate,
a gap
between this year and 2020. So let's talk about it. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. First, a trio of local news stories. Let's start with another political story. Last night, Bob Casey and Dave McCormick debated for the second and final time. Let's hear a little bit from yesterday's debate, starting mm-hmm. with Casey, ending with McCormick. Play the clip.
I've worked on behalf of the people of our state, fighting for working families, fighting for our children every day, fighting for seniors. My opponent, while I was working on all of that, was running the largest hedge fund in the world that invested in China, in Chinese oil companies, invested in an arms manufacturer.
He doesn't know how to create jobs. He doesn't understand the devastating effect of prices on families. He is a status quo candidate. He is a weak 30-year incumbent. Bob Casey didn't change Washington. Washington changed Bob Casey.
There you have it. They talked about price gouging, abortion, immigration, gun violence. At the risk of editorializing, it didn't seem like a game-changing debate, mm-hmm. but there was a debate, and I'll let the people decide whether it changed the game.
Yeah, I mean, what stood out to me, I think we didn't hear anything that, you know, surprised us from these candidates at this point, given the messaging that has been out there. But what did surprise me was a recent Inquirer, New York Times, Siena College poll that shows McCormick is now trailing Casey by just 4 percentage points among likely Pennsylvania voters. Now, the margin of error is about 3.3%. But, you know, a few weeks ago, when we're talking mid-September, Casey was leading by 9 points.
Narrowing.
Yeah. Now the gap has narrowed. But still with, you know, it still doesn't mean.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because Casey has never really polled above 50%.
Right.
So it wasn't like, you know, he was killing it or whatever. But
sure.
It shows that the needle has moved, at least among the folks who were polled.
Can I go on a tangent real quick about the polls?
Go ahead.
Okay.
I know how you. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. So these are 538. You know the website 538. Mm-hmm. These are polling averages. So in Pennsylvania, they have the average margin in the Senate race, Democrat plus 5. In the presidential race, Democrat plus 1. Now go to Michigan. Senate, Democrats plus 4. Presidential, Democrat plus 1. Wisconsin, Senate, Democrat plus 4, presidential, Democrat plus 1. Nevada, Senate, Democrat plus 9, presidential, Democrat plus 1. Same types of margins.
Yeah.
Arizona, Ohio, mm-hmm. Nebraska. Mm-hmm. It just, that doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel like we're going to mm-hmm. have a record number of ticket splitters. I feel like one of these, either the Senate polls are more right or the presidential polls are more right. And what we're going to find out November 5th is which one, because you can go back to 2020 when Donald Trump was running, or 2016. We did not see this type of divergence in outcomes between Senate and presidential races. It just doesn't make sense to me. And when I look at Pennsylvania, I just think either the Senate polls are right or the presidential polls are right. I don't think they can both be right.
It takes me back to 2016, how the polls were just wrong. You know, people were shocked at the outcome of that election. So, I mean, we shall see. I mean, you know, both of the campaigns are saying, you know, it's going to be close. It's going to be a razor thin margin, but we won't know.
That would suggest the presidential polls are right, and that McCormick is, in fact, much closer to Casey than these polls would suggest. I just don't know. To me, it doesn't make sense for them to all be this similar gaps going in the same direction, because every Senate race is different. Some are a Democrat incumbent. Some are Republican incumbent. Some are neither incumbent. Yeah. Like, it just doesn't make sense. And there's something weird going on. I would love a pollster to explain it to me.
Yeah. Somebody, please call Avi, okay?
Yeah, call me. You don't have to call during the show. Just email my personal line. We'll have a conversation about it.
For sure.
More politics now.
More politics. Yeah, there's a lot of concerns that are being expressed from top Democrats about VP Harris's ground game here in Pennsylvania. And some are calling what's going on a mess. Okay.
That doesn't sound good at all.
This is a story in Politico. And these leaders, they worry that the get out the vote effort is poorly run, that her campaign lacks relationships with key political figures in both the city and in the suburbs. With Ryan Boyer, who's the head of the building trades, one of the most powerful union leaders in the city, he went on record saying he has concerns that Harris's Pennsylvania campaign manager just doesn't have the type of deep knowledge of Philadelphia that she needs in order to get the turnout.
Called
that
her
is
out
needed.
By name.
Called her out by name. So
that seems rare.
Yeah, about 20 political leaders spoke to Politico for this article. I've also spoken to a lot of folks who are doing the get out the vote efforts on the ground. They're knocking on the doors, and the sentiment there is very similar.
Mm-hmm. I will point out
that
the woman who is running Harris's Pennsylvania campaign, she happens to be from a city called Pittsburgh.
Mm.
People in the city of Philadelphia don't often get along with people from the city of Pittsburgh. When we talk about Pennsylvania politics. So there could be a little bit of that going on, a little regional rivalry. But look, it's unusual for people to go on the record or even off the record to kind of diss their own campaign this close to Election Day. So, yeah, I think it's something to pay attention to. And that story is up right now at Politico.com. Another interesting note, someone said that the Democrats in Pennsylvania are not using specifically Sherelle Parker enough as a surrogate in Philadelphia.
And there have been closed door meetings, because this is also happening in the Latino community as well.
I would
folks
love for
saying,
one time to have an open door meeting.
Yeah,
they're always closed
door meetings with Harris leaders saying you're not using the right surrogates. By the way, $500 million in political TV ad spending is happening right here in Pennsylvania through the end of the year.
Oh, make it stop.
I know.
You know what? Let's make the political discussion stop for just a second, because we're going to get back to politics momentarily. And let's just talk about food. Because I don't want to talk about politics.
I like,
just for a second.
See,
give me
I like breakfast
seconds.
At home today, so my stomach is growling. Tell me about it.
So if you've ever had a Taco Bell Crunchwrap Supreme, you know what it tastes like. It's sort of like it's got crunchy inside. It's wrapped in a flour tortilla.
It's cheese.
There's some cheese. Yeah, it's melty. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good, actually. Mm-hmm. A Philly chef has been tapped to reinvent the Taco Bell Crunchwrap Supreme. This is a story in The Inquirer by Beef Orman about Taco Bell asking three young chefs across the country to come up with new versions of the Taco Bell Crunchwrap Supreme. And one of those three chefs is a Philly chef named Ruben Asaram. His Crunchwrap Supreme has roasted chicken, tomato curry, Mexican rice.
Curry?
Yes. Yes. Cilantro mint sauce and a little pico de gallo. And Ruben says it's inspired by childhood memories in Queens, New York, of eating butter chicken at Indian buffets.
I love butter chicken,
by the way. Such a good dish. honestly, just put that in the Crunchwrap. I would eat that. But so Ruben says that lots of this is the chef. He's a Philly chef. He grew up in New York, but he lives here now because he, you know, he got wise.
Yeah.
And he left New York and he moved here.
That's right.
And Ruben says that lots of Indian Americans like Taco Bell because it has a decent number of vegetarian options compared to other fast food establishments. I did not know that. So this is his Crunchwrap Supreme entry. We don't know if it will go national. They're going to make a decision early next year. But it could go on menus nationwide.
I will say this, that my college days, I spent a lot of time at Taco Bell.
I
haven't been in a while, but I would like to taste this, you know, this deliciousness, this Crunchwrap Supreme that he has created. And just because I love Indian food, too. So, yeah. Ruben.
Sounds like a nice crossover. Yeah. One of the other reinventions of the Crunchwrap Supreme has noodles in it. That shocked me. And another one has spicy chicken nuggets
in it. I saw that spicy chicken nuggets. That sounds a little delicious.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't tasted any of them. But just looking at the description, I think I would go chicken nuggets over noodles. But I'm very open-minded when it comes to food. You know that.
I know. You love a good lunch.
I love a good lunch. Hey, let's play a little music sting now and transition. Oh, there's that music again.
Mm-hmm.
So dramatic.
I know. Special.
We're going to turn now to today's theme for this Studio 2 special countdown to Election Day.
Yes, recent polls have shown that Donald Trump has gained support among black voters. On the other side, Harris seems to have lost the enthusiasm other presidential Democratic nominees had in the past.
Here's our question for you. What do you think is driving this change in support for the Democratic Party? Do you think it's real or just some polling error? We especially want to hear from black and African American voters today. What's the conversation like in your family? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org.
I want to welcome our guests that are in studio with us. We have Timothy Welbeck, director of the Center for Anti-Racism at Temple University. We also have Randy Robinson, president and CEO of political consulting group RRR Consulting LLC. Gentlemen, welcome to Studio 2.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
On the line, we're joined by LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, associate professor of politics at Princeton University and the author of Race to the Bottom: How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And so, you know, before we dig into this issue, I want to just address the fact that there's been a lot of talk about black voters and whether this critical voting bloc will turn out for Vice President Harris on November 5th. Each of you has a slightly different take on this issue, but I want you to each answer why you think there seems to be this sounding of an alarm and whether you think there is real cause for concern. And LaFleur, we'll start with you, then we'll go to Randy and then Timothy. LaFleur, your thoughts.
Sure. I would say that some of the polling data, we cannot completely trust it. So every year, you know, or every election year, the media makes these claims, I would say going back as early as the early 2000s, saying that black people are going to shift right and are going to shift Republican. And I would say typically this has not really been borne out in the data and it's been overstated. That being said, it seems like there's probably some internal polling that suggests that the Harris campaign has reason to be concerned. But I do think much of this is overstated. And as the conversation unfolds, I'm happy to share more about why I think that's the case.
Okay. And Randy, I know longtime conservative, your thoughts on this?
Yeah. Also longtime Philadelphian. I think to a small degree, there's something very legitimate about it. And then some of the things that I think are maybe just kind of overstated in some certain dynamic. If you look at just the performance of African-American voters just over the past three or four presidential cycles, you see there has been a drop off in the sense of particularly male voters with the Democratic Party's agenda. So I think there's a concern there. But still overwhelmingly, black men have been voting who are Democrat, been consistently voting pretty much like black women. But this race is so tight, where we got to count all the coins, you know, you go to the store and you digging for them nickels that's down in the bottom of your wallet. Like, you need them this time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this is what happens. You look down and say, hey, I know there's four nickels down there. And you look down and there's three.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you an alarm. Yeah. So, and I think there's a concern. So the whole issue of black men not supporting Kamala for whatever reasons, like other presidential candidates, I think that's a myth. Then also, too, like, you know, you have this false high bar that was set by Barack Obama, and no campaign expect to replicate that level of of support.
And he got 95% of the black electorate during that
which is crazy. He got 95% of black people to go one direction. I have an issue with that. But nonetheless, yeah, there was a large 95%. So there's this invisible bar that was set by this, like, you know, unicorn candidate. But then it's cycling back. But I think it's the loss of black voters, or not loss of black voters. Is it because they're going right? I think they're becoming disenfranchised and disinterested in the body of politics as a whole.
Oh, interesting.
You. Yeah, Timothy.
I tend to agree with those sentiments. In a broader sense, just as been already said, black people are the most consistent and loyal voting bloc for the Democratic Party, leading with black women, then with black men. And while the polling might suggest that there has been some drop-off, for the most part, I would anticipate the voting to be what it has been for the past several presidential cycles, and that is just as recently as yesterday, it was reported that 81% of black men are leaning towards voting for Vice President Harris. So as it relates to that, I believe that we will see similar trends when people actually step into the voting booth. But in terms of the concern, it is because this will be a tight election. Yeah. Just again, looking at the polling numbers and looking at the larger discourse that's happening primarily online, I think, is where it's the loudest. Mm. And I think that's where we're getting a significant number of people looking at this potential voting bloc shifting in the ways that they haven't in the past. So with a tight election, some loud voices, I think that's what's driving the significant amount of attention we've seen on this.
So in summary, what I hear a lot of you saying, mm-hmm. I think maybe all three of you saying, is it's not like there's a sea change happening, but any little shift in any voter bloc this election matters a lot. Let's bring on a caller now. Mm-hmm. This is Al from North Philadelphia. Al, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Good afternoon. I am a black male, and I'm largely immune to the attempts to co-opt me as an African-American male. I just know too much about history, and I'm too conscious for that. However, something does get to me, and I have to use my intellect to overcome it, which is really disappointing. The emotional appeals that seem to be swaying white women of these commercials, these Trump commercials, where they continuously show Kamala Harris as someone who has let criminals off, and then you see the impacts on their families. Very emotional commercials that have been running for 2 months in Pennsylvania. What I don't see that would help tremendously is Kamala Harris doing what she promised to do. Show her the prosecutor. Show these people that she's convicted. The criminals she's thrown in jail and the effects they've had on victims and their communities. Mm-hmm. But we don't see any of that. And that, I think, would help to pull back in a lot of people who are straying from her, because they keep hearing and seeing these negative, false portrayals of her as a permissive individual. We never see her as the prosecutor and the good, the protection that she's doing, that she's done. I'm sure there must be hundreds.
And Al, we are coming up on a break, and I want to make sure our panel gets a chance
to
respond.
Al.
But a great insight. So is there something off with the messaging? And I think that's what Al is getting at. Timothy Welbeck, what do you think? Is there something off with Harris's messaging?
In terms of the messaging, I do think that there was an inadequacy to convey the effectiveness of the Biden administration. And to the extent that the Biden administration has been effective and had policies that positively impact the black community, there has been an ineffectiveness in communicating that. And we live in an era where letting the work speak for itself is insufficient for many people. And so people need to not only have the work, but be told what the work is and what is being done. And so obviously, as vice president, she's associated with the Biden administration. Obviously, there are policy differences and the like. But as it relates to that, I think that's where the failure of the messaging is. And also while we're seeing some of this blitz that we're seeing in recent weeks to have specific policies, particularly the black male opportunity proposals that were released the other day. I think that's why we're seeing some of that level of specificity in these closing weeks.
Real quick, Randy Robinson, we only have about 30 seconds. What do you think about Harris?
To Al's point, this is why you haven't seen commercials from Kamala's camp showing her as the prosecutor defender, because polling data always suggests in political circles that law and order usually goes to the right.
Yeah.
It's a positive for the right. And for her, again, this is a truncated campaign. So she had to hyper-energize what her natural base was. So the conversation is about women's issues, women, abortion, the family, and that dynamic. They had to build that base and identity for her first before they could actually go into this more sterner issues about crime and law and order and commander-in-chief.
That's a great peek behind the curtains there.
And we're going to talk about the gender gap that is happening in this presidential election, as well as other issues when we come back. If you want to chime in, what are you hearing from the black voting electorate? You can call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. What do you think turnout will be? If you're a black voter, we want to hear from you. studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
And this is Studio 2 in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Welcome back to this Studio 2 special countdown to Election Day. Today, we're talking about black voter support for the presidential candidates, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. I want to reintroduce our guests. We have LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, Associate Professor of Politics at Princeton University and author of Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. We have Timothy Welbeck, Director of the Center for Anti-Racism at Temple University, and Randy Robinson, President and CEO of political consulting group RRR Consulting LLC.
And our question for you at home today, what do you think is driving the change in support for the Democratic Party among black voters, or is it actually changing at all? We especially want to hear from black and African-American voters today. What is the conversation like in your family? Email studio2@whyy.org or give us a call, 888-477-9499. And how about another caller here?
Yeah,
this is Drew from Philly, who says, don't treat black voters as a monolith. Drew, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Yes, I mean, you have to also see that it's not only African Americans who were born here, but there is also immigrants who've come. I lived in Florida for a long time. I'm a Philly resident born here, but the Haitians tend to vote Republican. And then you have other immigrants from maybe Jamaica or Africa or Nigeria who tend to be conservative religiously. So you have to really look at us as a very diverse group of people rather than a monolith.
Mm-hmm. Great point from
that
Drew.
That is a great point.
In Philadelphia. LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, can you respond to that? And maybe to build off of it, if we are sort of looking within this voting bloc, where do we see the possibility for Republicans to make the biggest gains?
Okay, great. I'm glad that you asked me that. So I agree with the caller that there is heterogeneity within the black community. But I think he's really overstating this idea that, you know, black immigrants are voting Republican. They might be somewhat more socially conservative, but the data bears this out, that black people, as they're socialized in the United States, you know, even as they come as immigrants, they have a similar black experience, a similar experience with racism in the United States, which makes them more likely to vote for Democrats. And they look quite comparable to their native born black peers. So I would say that that's actually a bit of a misstatement or overstatement in terms of Republican support among African Americans. Yes, it is a heterogeneous group, but that sort of heterogeneity, I don't think typically bears itself out at the voting booth, in particular because we're in a two-party system. And so in terms of the actual options, most Black people, even if they're not enthusiastic about the Democratic Party, there's a sense that they're going to choose the better of two evils. And I think that's what we're going to continue to see. In terms of Republicans being able to potentially pick off some Black voters, I mean, I think it's possible. And I think if anything, it's maybe to be among those who are the most religiously conservative in terms of people who might have concerns with the Democratic Party's stance on, quote unquote, cultural and moral issues, whether that's with respect to the LGBTQ community or even Harris's prominent role or posturing around abortion. But again, I think much of this is likely overstated.
Yeah, I want to talk about the issue because the issue that has been coming up over and over and over again is the issue of whether Black men will abandon the Democratic Party. And I want to talk about the gender gap more generally, because according to the Wall Street Journal, there's a wide gender gap in the polls right now. Trump had a 5-point advantage among men in 2020. Now that advantage has widened, some say as much as to 16 points. And President Biden had a 12-point edge among women in 2020, but Harris's lead among women now is as high as 19 points, considering, you know, determining what poll you look at. I want you to talk about, LaFleur, this gender gap. How wide is it, and does it extend to the Black vote as well?
The gender gap is real. And I think what, for me, as a political scientist, is a bit frustrating is that there is a gender gap even among African Americans. Black women are always a bit more Democratic relative to their Black male counterparts. But what has also been stated is that Black men are literally the second most Democratic voting bloc next to Black women. And so if we want to talk about, you know, concerns about sexism or concerns about a gender gap, I think we have to be critical in understanding that that's not unique to the Black community. She is polling, as you noted, worse among men of all races. And I think that's something that needs to be, I think, reiterated and mentioned in much of this media narrative, and not with this sort of hyper focus on this idea that this sort of sexism, or at least the gender gap, is unique to Black men.
Yeah.
Randy Robinson, I'd love to get your response to what we just heard.
Yeah.
I mean, so do you think that where the Harris campaign is most vulnerable is among voters who are more culturally, socially conservative within the Black electorate? Because what's interesting to me is that when you look at the new proposals highlighted by the Harris campaign, a lot of them are about entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. They're about finances, economy, you know, healthcare for sickle cell disease, marijuana legalization. They don't seem to me to really speak to a socially or culturally conservative voter. So do you agree that that's where the vulnerability is? How do you make sense of these policies?
Let me dial us back. I think the professor said something that I was concerned about. And she said that there may be an opportunity to pick off a couple of Black voters on the right. No, you don't have to pick off Black voters because that's an assumption that they belong on the left. Mm. There is a large and growing amount of moderately Christian conservatives, African Americans. They do exist. Unfortunately, they're swallowed up in these urban capitals, and the fact that their impact on their vote just isn't measured. But the approach in terms of the monolith, and I think the caller talked about, you know, the African American community isn't a monolith, and he's talking about the new immigrant population, which is actually growing, whom are Black people, and will largely align themselves with the political ideals of American-born Blacks. But you look also, too, that if they're talking about particularly Haitians in Boston, if they're in urban capitals, I would want them to drill down and look at races where it really was a competitive race between a legitimate Republican and Democrat. Because usually in these urban capitals, it's not really a race between a Democrat and Republican on a local level. It's only when these national races coming to bear. So I think a lot of our immigrants and Africans and Haitian immigrants they do have very, very conservative values and also family values, and also believe in and represent a patriarchal system, which I think the Donald Trump camp has appealed to the fact that...
Is that Trump's appeal?
Yeah.
Do you think that's Trump's appeal? Because why now, though? Because Trump's, this is the third time he's run. If it's going to change now, why would it change now?
Well, it's absolute masculinity. that's what the appeal is. But now, why is it growing or not growing? I don't think that's relative to Trump or Kamala herself. I think that's relative to the social conditions and the political conditions that men have experienced over the past 4 to 8 to 12 years.
Yeah, and Timothy, I want to kind of follow up on this line of questioning, because one of the things that people have said to me is that Trump is not afraid to specifically say the word Black, to target black voters, black men specifically. And this is the first time we're really hearing with the economic agenda that, mm-hmm. that Harris has come out with. Was this a missed opportunity for Harris, given that she did not specifically target this demographic until recently?
Well, first, we have to remember that she's been the nominee for less than 100 days.
So, but still, she could have come off the blocks with that.
She could have come out the gate with that, but to the extent that former President Trump has an agenda that's supposed to be uplifting of black men, he had an opportunity to do that when he was president of the United States. He's run for president 3 times. He's only mentioned black people in his performative, tokenish way. Particularly when he's trying to signal that he has support in what he's presuming should be unexpected. But in terms of an agenda that's supposed to be uplifting and affirming of black men and the unique issues that they face, I don't believe that he has authored or presented policies that are designed to do that. As it relates to the proposals that were presented by Vice President Harris, it's a part of this broader theory that, yes, there are unique challenges that black people face, but many of the policy initiatives that they need are things that will generally benefit the broader society. But to the level that there's specificity, there is specificity in trying to undo systemic harms around finances, around health care, family building, home ownership, things like that.
And let me bring in a clip now from Kamala Harris that I think speaks to this point. Mm-hmm. This is Vice President Kamala Harris speaking yesterday, I believe, to popular radio host Charlemagne the God on The Breakfast Club. And she's responding to a question about misinformation. Let's hear that clip.
So that not only has my work been about ensuring that we have some of the lowest black unemployment ever in our country, but that also knowing that that should be a baseline that everybody has a job. Mm-hmm. And what we should be invested in is also building wealth in the community and intergenerational wealth. And I have many, many examples of that. But again, part of the challenge that I face is that they are trying to scare people away because they know they otherwise have nothing to run on. Ask Donald Trump what his plan is for black America. Ask him.
Well, and here's a quote from The Atlantic, June 2024. The wage gap between black and white Americans has shrunk to its lowest point since at least the 1980s. Also, every single income bracket saw net worth increase considerably. This is during the Biden administration. But the biggest gains went to poor, middle class, black, Latino, and younger households. Here's Harris saying, Randy Robinson, look at our record. We've delivered. Mm-hmm. You asked us to help make gains. Here are the gains.
Well, again, they need to communicate that. But look at it like this. In terms of the demographic, the low propensity voter that the GOP is actually targeting.
Mm-hmm.
At 16 years old, 2008, let's say 16 years old, Barack Obama's president.
Mm-hmm.
16 years later, that was 16 years old, 30-something years old. You've had 12 years of Democratic administration, 4 years of Trump.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at it on a whole, and I'm telling you, they're saying that, well, we've had three administrations of Democratic leadership, and nothing has happened or changed for us. The conditions in my community.
Talking about sort of a young 30s black voter.
Yeah, so this young 30s voter is not looking at this historical performances that they articulate in terms of these historical gains and wealth gap stuff. They're looking at half my life has been under Democratic rule and nothing has changed for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're looking particularly even more so in these urban capitals with the, you know, particularly seesawing in terms of crime rates. But here's the biggest dynamic why they can't sell the Democratic that this the issue with communicating with some of these voters who are falling off.
Yeah.
When I come out of my house and I'm from North Philly, I look around in Philadelphia and I see everything changing. I see a Philadelphia is being built and built and built and does not seem to appear to include me, even though I still have African-American leaders in terms of political office. So I'm saying, here's a country and a city that's progressing right beyond me, and I don't feel included.
I want to bring in a caller. We have Ray from Philadelphia who has a comment about black voters. Ray, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, I think as an African-American voter, as a man, I think this discussion around who's going to go for Trump and what's their percentages is really, when you talk to brothers, a real apathetic sort of cynicism, sort of protest vote discussion. And I think the narrative of us coming out the way we have been is going to be true. But also, to be very candid, the campaign's job is to make the numbers meet to 51. It's not to complain about you don't have this many, you don't have that.
It's a fair point.
Your job at the end of the day, when the confetti goes away, is to make sure you find 51%. That's your job. So do your job.
There it is.
Right. There it is. Do it up.
Yeah, I mean, that is the heart of the matter, though.
That is the heart of the matter. I want to ask you about the couch, because everybody's been talking about, you know, will, you know, voters go towards, you know, Trump? Will they go towards Harris, specifically black voters? But the couch is the third option. Mm-hmm. LaFleur, I'd like you to comment on that. I mean, that is something this, you know, is there a lack of enthusiasm? Is the couch becoming more option for folks who feel like, you know what, they're not talking to me, I'm just going to tap out? And could, and what kind of impact could that have on the outcome of the election?
Yeah, I think that's the more pertinent question. I think the couch is maybe more attractive or more likely relative to this idea that black people are going to shift to Trump. There's a certain level of disillusionment that I think Randy and Timothy both spoke to. And, you know, unfortunately, some of that really started under the Obama administration. And so it's a bit ironic, actually, in many ways, to hear him chastise black male voters for sexism, because, you know, as the first black president, some of that disillusionment that I think that black voters are experiencing are not really seeing the sort of realization of maybe the hopes and dreams that they hoped would, you know, come to fruition under a black president. It started, you know, back in 2008. And, you know, president's a hard job. There's, you know, only certain things that they can actually control. But I think what we're seeing is that sort of disillusionment over time with the Democratic Party, where people don't feel that they have received maybe tangible benefits. And, you know, like, to just take us back some time, it's the economy, stupid. I think it's really about people's pockets. And so we can quote numbers about, you know, wealth gain under the Biden administration. But when people are going to the grocery store and things are higher and they don't feel like they have money in their pockets, and of course, inflation is a global phenomenon, but it's that sort of pocketbook issue that I think is really resonating with people. And I think that could really lead to a choice to stay on the couch.
And I just want to play those comments from Barack Obama that you referenced. This is Barack Obama, and I believe he's in Pittsburgh. He's at a field office talking to campaign personnel and volunteers, and he's talking directly to, he says, he's talking directly to black men. Let's hear former President Obama.
I've got a problem with that, because part of it makes me think, and I'm speaking to men directly, part of it makes me think that, well, you just aren't feeling the idea of having a woman as president. And you're coming up with other alternatives and other reasons for that.
Professor had a problem with those statements. And Randy, do you have a problem with those statements too?
Yeah, I think good old President Obama has forgotten a couple critical things. He's our first black president, right? But Obama's mixed race. What really, really drove down his real asset, what made him really endeared by the community, was that black wife of his. So now, had he sent her to have a conversation with black men about what's happening, it would have been a little bit more legitimate. And also, again, this is a real stuff. So, and then unfortunately, for Kamala, she doesn't have two assets that Obama had that I think really won the election for him. Obama had Michelle, a black wife. She's talking about men and black men, but she can't send her husband to be a surrogate. Obama had beautiful black children that endeared to everyone. She doesn't have children. So there are a couple assets that she doesn't have,
Randy,
that she can't drill down in the black community. So this is why.
Well, let me ask Timothy Welbeck. You agree with that?
First of all, Vice President Harris has children.
Yes,
I do not like that narrative. What I will say is that I do think Randy is right in that Michelle Obama did endear people to President Obama. That is true. But overall, I don't believe that is the full scope of the weakness here of the Harris campaign. As it relates to these broader issues we're talking about, I think a lot of it distills down to some of what the clips that you played earlier. There's been a misinformation and disinformation campaign that has attacked her. There is some misogyny at the root of some of the critiques and attacks against her. I would also add, LaFleur is right in that there's a deep level of cynicism in part because people don't feel as though their everyday lives have changed. An anecdote that I've heard someone say is that when we talk about the economy may be booming, but I've heard people say that I've made more money than I ever have, and I'm broker than I've ever been. And that's the impact of inflation impacting people's everyday lives. And yes, it is a global phenomenon, as LaFleur mentioned. And yes, the Inflation Reduction Act has had some positive benefits in mitigating inflation. But overall, I think it's those types of issues. Also, just the feeling of broken promises and things like that. And so I'll end by saying that, again, I think LaFleur is right, that to the extent that there's deviation from typical polling, it'll be these disillusioned voters, the cynic who won't vote at all or who might vote third party. I think that's a larger point of deviation, if there's any.
Yeah, and I want to read this comment from Andre, who says, I'm definitely voting. However, a lot of my friends plan to sit this election out. They don't trust any of the candidates. They don't feel represented. So that's exactly what you were talking about, Timothy. And I want to play this clip Vice President Kamala Harris had from an audio town hall with Charlemagne the God on the Breakfast Club yesterday. Take a listen to this.
I had a politician tell me once that if you're running for a national election, it's bad electoral strategy to say you are going to do things specifically for Black people, which is why a lot of politicians don't speak directly to their plans for Black people. Is that a thing?
I don't know that that's true. I think that what is true is that I am running to be a president for everybody. Mm-hmm. But I am clear-eyed about the history and the disparities that exist for specific communities, and I'm not going to shy away from that. It doesn't mean that my policies aren't going to benefit everybody, because they are. Everything I just talked about.
And I want to kind of get back to this topic, because I want to dig into it more. You know, Harris is promising now, you know, money for Black male entrepreneurs with startup ideas. She's talking about student loan incentives to support Black men who want to become teachers. She launched Black Men Huddle Up. And I want to just ask you, Timothy, and I want you to also kind of, you know, chime in here. You know, she's a Black and Asian woman who doesn't really talk about her gender or her race. And then issues all of these initiatives directed towards Black men. Will this work, or does this feel like what you were talking about, Timothy? A whole, the land of broken promises, a bunch of stuff close to the election. Your reaction to that?
In a general sense, I hope it moves the needle and that people hear that there are specifically their specific policy proposals with them in mind, particularly because what you want of your politicians is that you want to hear, you want them to hear your concerns and respond favorably. And so one of the narratives that was emerging was that she is not listening to Black men. There was this lament that other groups were having policy proposals directed specifically towards their unique concerns, and Black men did not have that. She comes out with that, and she comes out with something that's more robust than any of her predecessors have specifically targeted towards Black men in name. So I would hope it moves the needle. I still believe that there's a broad sense of skepticism. And honestly, these disengaged skeptics are not following the news cycle closely. And so much of the rhetoric that you hear from them are regurgitated talking points that you might see parroted from social media and things like that. But they aren't really informed and engaged, because if they were informed and engaged, I think some of the conversation would be different.
Let me read a comment from Dale, who says, it is sad for anyone who was only given the right to vote as a result of people standing for what's right and sacrificing their lives to merely decide not to vote. No vote is a vote.
Yeah.
We have come this far to just decide to go no further. Very sad. And Amira agrees with that, says, that's right. If you never fought for anything, you will never understand. People died so we can vote. I will never stay home. It's my right. We got only a minute left. Real quick, from each of you. November 6th, day after the election, will we be talking about the Black vote turnout as a deciding factor in this election? LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, I'll start with you.
Yes, how can we not? We'll be talking about Black turnout in Georgia, Black turnout in Pennsylvania, of course, Black turnout in Michigan. Black people will have a pivotal role in this election. There's no two ways about it.
Randy Robinson.
Well, on November 6th, I hope we have an outcome by then, but nonetheless.
That's true. That November 13th, there you go.
My heart and soul is with the Black community. So I think November 6th, November 7th, December 11th, 12th, there has to be an ongoing conversation about the ills and the things that are facing Black people, and not just in electoral cycles. Mm. Because unfortunately, when you put out great policy, it only makes it seem transactional. Yep.
Timothy Welbeck, real quick.
I agree with all of that. The Black vote will turn this election, and I can't tell you who to vote for, but I will say vote is a right that was purchased in blood. It was fought for dearly.
Timothy Welbeck, director of the Center for Anti-Racism at Temple University, thank you for your insights this hour. Randy Robinson, president and CEO of the political consulting group RRR Consulting, LLC. Thank you, Randy. And LaFleur Stevens-Duke, an associate professor of politics at Princeton, author of Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. Thanks to you as well. Let's wrap it up.
Yeah, that wraps up our show. Lots of thank yous to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes, Charlie Kyer, and Al Banks, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.